She's always been the type of person that just says things and she just speaks her mind. I guess that has a little bit to do with not having a formal education.
Hi everyone, welcome back to The Body Serve. This is episode 12. I'm James.
I'm Jonathan. And you say back because it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long layoff, so we apologize.
And every time I say something like that, it's been a while, I just hear Aaliyah in my head. It's been a long time, shouldn't have left you.
Oh, I think of Nickelback, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Without a dope beat to step two, step two. This is how I live my life, with like 90s, early 2000s music. But it was for good reason. You were sick. You were the party pooper.
I had strep in May. It sucked. So I'm back. Back to life. It's been a really emotional week for us, or past 2 days, really, in TV land.
Well, more so for you. You stand for Mad Men much more than I do.
Yeah, my beloved Mad Men came to a close on Sunday. I found it really satisfying. And I was really, really happy with the finale, aside from really the last 30 seconds, which I just don't care about.
My problem with that show is that I've always enjoyed the depiction of the woman on the show much more than anything they'll ever do with Don Draper. Yeah. And the fact that it's such a Don Draper-centric show and he drives it as a protagonist has always been a problem for me. So I get why people, you know, laud it as the greatest thing since sliced bread. As far as TV shows go, but it will never be like top five for me because of that.
That's sad. You know how I do have a soft spot for morose, mopey people and men, especially like Andy Murray. You know, so
I would not even remotely compare the two. Like
no,
Andy
no,
Murray
no.
is not a full on asshole like Don Draper.
No,
like,
but Don Draper is not a great guy.
Okay.
And he's committed a lot of sins,
uh-huh.
But he insists on punishing himself for everything.
Sounds like a lot of mansplaining to me.
You know, I actually liked Don's sort of quasi-enlightenment toward the end. And I did like that it was touched with a bit of skepticism as well. You know, that there is this idea that maybe he took what he learned at this self-help camp and co-opted it into this brilliant Coke ad, right?
See, my reading of Don is that I wouldn't have seen it as him learning something to take with him the rest of his life, more so than just, you know, really being opportunist and seeing a great ad opportunity.
Right.
You know, and like that's when he's crying on that dude's shoulder, it's like a moment of realization. Well, yes, I can finally come back and take it all back, you know? Like, I'm so cynical about him.
Mm. Oh, that's fair. I actually like watching the show cynically.
Mm.
But I was really, really happy with, you know, a lot of people thought the Peggy and Stan scene was too, like, rom-com.
I mean, it was, but it also gave us one of the funniest lines of the season when he's professing his love and all Peggy can say is, what?
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 What did you say? Oh, that's what I thought you said. You know,
well, I guess it makes sense that I should love you because, you know, okay, I guess I am in love with you. It was.
Yeah, but Elizabeth Moss's performance was so measured that I think in the hands of a lesser performer, the scene would have come off a little schmaltzy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But God, you just cannot look away when she's performing like that.
No. And the shallow part of me, which I fear is more than 50%, just can't get on. I mean, if I were to watch the show with blindfolds, I would probably think they have the most amazing relationship. In terms of really rooting for them, but I can't get past tense looks. I just can't.
A lot of women are really into the beard.
I
our friend Meg included. Oh, she loves Stan.
Yeah, I'm not about that life.
I like Stan. I'm not physically attracted to Stan, but I find him really charming. And he's someone who helps Peggy because she can be very aggressive interpersonally, you know? And she's so intense that he can sort of smooth her out a little bit.
Well, yeah, they've kind of created this mini Don, but without the charm, you know? which is some kind of commentary, too, on how women exist in that kind of corporate world back then. You know, so I get all that.
Yeah, I get what you mean. And, you know, Joan, on the other hand, is a character who was always allowed to be charming and sexy. And when we first met her, was kind of the best at playing the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, that game kind of destroyed her career and, you know, looked like it was nearly going to destroy her.
She was no longer willing to play the game as well.
Right. Because, I mean, she's someone who has suffered greatly at the hands of misogyny.
All the women on the show have.
She was raped by her fiance at work, you know? But, you know, seeing her so
confident.
I was actually going to say seeing her so helpless in the previous episode was devastating. But seeing her sort of choose work over a man was really exciting in this one.
I was kind of fantasizing about Peggy and Joan going off to start their own company together and bursting through the doors a la First Wives Club, you know, to the tune of Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves, you know, which would have been not the tone of the show. I get it. But that was what I was really looking for. I think we were sitting and watching and you immediately said, this is not going to happen. This is not what the show is about.
It's sad, but that is, it's too like fan service, you know, like this is the dream that makes fan fiction. Olsen Holloway.
And then she ends up giving the company both her names.
Yeah, which was awesome.
Yeah.
Harris Holloway.
We spend a lot of our time watching TV and are invested in pop culture quite a bit. So bear with us as we talk about a few things, because these few topics like really riled something in us these last few days.
Yeah.
Tennis is coming, not to worry.
Well, Game of Thrones was the other big Sunday story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the most talked about scene of that episode was the final scene, which was Sansa's rape at the hands of her new husband, Ramsay Bolton. So I guess book readers knew it was coming. I've stopped reading the book, so I don't really know what's going on.
But also apparently there was a departure from the books in terms of the TV show, in that scene was to have happened with somebody else.
Right. It was another character.
Which I didn't know about that.
Who is like a more minor player in Winterfell.
Mm-hmm.
And who was a friend of Sansa's way back in the day. And apparently she was in the first season. I don't remember. Her name was Jane Poole.
I mean, these details are really the least of it for me.
Well, right.
Why do these writers feel like this show is so good that they can wantonly depict rape however they want, whenever they want, unnecessarily departing from the books and have it be okay? You know, like, I'm treading on thin water with this show right now.
Thin ice. That's a lot of mixed metaphors. You're treading water.
I'm treading.
Anyway. Yeah, so there, you know, there was a lot of discussion and a lot of outrage about this particular scene. And the way it was filmed, it was interesting because it didn't show Sansa at all, which, thank God, but it zoomed in on Theon as if it was Theon's pain that we should be caring about, you know? And what I object to about Game of Thrones is that, first of all, they've added rape scenes that never occurred in the books, or made sexually violent encounters even more violent than they were in the books, which is saying something, because George R.R. Martin is fairly sadistic in the way that he writes sex scenes. The first example is Daenerys and Khal Drogo's wedding night.
Jason Momoa.
And so in the book, it was disturbing, yes, but he waited for her to consent. He waited for her to say yes, literally. And in the series, it was really shown as more of a rape, and she was sobbing through the whole thing, and it was horrible to watch. So the series has kind of a history of amplifying those situations. And I also don't think that the writers have been able to show kind of the depth of pain and suffering that that rape causes women.
Well, also because a lot of the show is depicted from the male gaze, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it be the gratuitous and disproportionate nudity between women and men on the show, for right. one. And then as you talked about with that rape scene with Sansa, having it being viewed through the eyes of Theon. Mm. You know, that's a really big problem for me. You know, I just imagine like a bunch of men like scratching their balls in a room, like drinking beer, like thinking about how best they can like violate women this week.
Yeah, but like I don't think that, I don't know. Like, I don't think that they're that blasé about it, but the like relying on the threat of sexual assault as a plot device is lazy, and it's also dramatically inert.
That is blasé, because, well, yeah. I mean, if you're talking about a so-called prestige show that, you know, makes so much money, costs so much money to make, is shot in so many different exotic locations across the world. Like, this is the biggest show on TV for all intents and purposes. Yeah. Like, a lot more thought and critical thought should go into how they depict these things.
Right.
I'm just over it. The other thing we watched this weekend, we watched a movie, which we don't often do.
Right.
We don't go to the movies as much as we would like because, frankly, it's almost always shit.
Although I do want to see Mad Max right now.
But we had wanted to watch Beyond the Lights for quite a while, and we finally got, I guess we finally remembered to watch it this weekend. And it wasn't the greatest thing ever, but it was such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, it was directed by the same woman who directed Love and Basketball. I've actually never seen Love and Basketball.
Meg's
going
to
be so mad at me for that, because she lent me the VHS tape a long time ago. But how would you describe it?
It's as if Rihanna were doing a reboot of The Bodyguard.
Come on. So it's about a young pop star who's sort of struggling with her burgeoning fame.
Mm-hmm.
A terrible, terrible stage mom.
It has a touch of About a Boy in it.
Okay.
With like the young British kid performing in front of a school. And then she blossoms into this big North American pop star who's like hoeing it up everywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And her mother is exploiting her, and that causes friction. Mm. The mother doesn't care that she's being hypersexualized, you know, being auctioned off into different relationships,
right?
You know, for the purposes of furthering her career. And then she attempts suicide, and this security guard, who is an actual policeman, saves her life, and then they fall in love. And
don't give the whole thing away, my God.
Well, I mean, there's no secrets. It's a pretty basic plot line.
Okay.
You know, like, and that's all that I talked about there is the first 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and then it kind of develops from there. But, you know, we were remarking about how few films are made for adult audiences anymore that aren't, you know, these big blockbuster, let's make $500 million on like Superman, like beating up Batman rubbish. You know, the which is why we were so excited too to go watch the what was it, the next best Marigold Hotel?
Yes, the second best.
Yeah,
right.
The first time we watched the first one together in theaters, and we were the only people under 50 that day.
Under 65.
Right. There are a lot of people with walkers that day, and there's just such a paucity of good filmmaking out there made for mass audiences. And also, this was a mainly all black film, which was really great to watch too.
You know, it's not just, it doesn't have to be great filmmaking though. There's not really sort of this market anymore for like middle brow movies.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those movies in the 80s and 90s featured women heavily, you know. So it's actually, there's been a lot of research that it's actually a lot worse for actresses in 2015 than it was, say, 20 years ago.
I saw something today where Selma Hayek said that, you know, studio companies don't believe that women are economic forces in the business anymore. When you're talking about, like, middle-brow movies, what we have is Paul Blart. You know?
Yeah. And, you know, there is a place for Paul Blart, I guess. But the market is totally driven by cross-promotion now and to video games and, you know, crap like that. So it's really, like, run by teenage boys. And, you know, I saw The Avengers, the first one. It's all right. But we don't need, like, 50 movies in the next 5 years from the Marvel Universe.
And then you're going to, you have to buy, like, your surround sound to watch the DVD when you go home in 3D and blah, blah, blah. And it's just...
Well, it's a gold mine, obviously. But it's not made for grown-ups.
No, I feel entirely isolated from movies these days.
Right, but you have grown-ups watching these movies and thinking that this is the way that the world works. You know, it's a very juvenile way to look at the world. And we don't have to get into all of that.
That's because these movies aren't targeting women. And if they are now, it's about, like, Magic Mike, shake your dick in my face, to be frank, you know? Like selling a sexual fantasy or 50 Shades, you know? This idea of what women's sexuality should be.
Right.
Hollywood's got some serious problems.
And, I mean, that's why people are watching TV. Because there's a lot of great television drama being made. Where characters actually matter. And they're not afraid of a little talk. I love talky movies, you know?
Slow-paced films, there's something to be said
like
for that.
Like made for grown-ups who are mature enough to follow it.
Like you want to think about what somebody is saying.
Yeah.
You know? What's wrong with that? Here ends that rant and the preamble to the tennis podcast, which is what you're here for.
So anyway, yeah, I need to decompress. Let's talk about tennis.
Last time we had introduced a new segment, See What Had Happened Was, which would run in conjunction with our previous segment named The Tennis Player. This week, because we're leading up to Roland Garros and we're behind on when this episode should have come out, and that means we're going to be doing another episode, probably on Friday, to be released into the weekend. We're going to split up those segments with See What Happened Was this time and then name the tennis player for, you could say, part B of our French Open preview. And so this week's See What Happened Was is inspired by something I actually wrote for my own website, sportscribe.ca, this week, where I did kind of like a BuzzFeed kind of thing of 10 reasons why Mariah and Serena are basically the same person. And one of the reasons was that they're both so skilled at throwing shade. And the example that I used for Serena is what we'll be using for this segment. So go ahead. You want to go ahead?
Sure. So it was in her... from her press conference after she won the Olympics, in which she beat Maria Sharapova 6-love, 6-1, which I'm sure you all remember the score. And so,
it's still a silver medal.
Exactly. Yes. Congratulations. And so this interviewer, first of all, was really looking for some shade.
Uh-huh.
Because this question, were you trying to win 6-love, 6-love? Wink. And she's...
I mean, you can't fault Serena for that response. Like, she's just won a second gold medal to go with her umpteen other gold medals in singles and doubles combined. She's on top of the world. And then you...
And you throw her this softball, and she really took the bait.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, that would have been awesome, only because against Maria, if you give her any hope, she's trying to come back. Okay, Serena, try to stay focused because she's so good. When she won that one game, I could see her pumping her fists. I was like, oh boy, here she comes.
Here she comes.
It was important for me to go out there and do everything. So note, when she won that one game, that was not a mistake from Serena Williams. I like that she mentioned she was pumping her fist, because Maria pumps her fist after any point that she wins. So it's not really like a sign that she's coming back, you know?
I'm surprised that, and if you saw the video going around this week of the ball kid in Rome who was trying to run to get her an umbrella, and he fell. But he recovered with such grace. I'm surprised she didn't do a fist pump for him.
I know.
You know?
He just totally face planted behind her chair. And she just turned around like, what is going on back there?
That was amazing.
Poor kid. But Maria and Serena's shade rivalry has really has mellowed a lot recently.
No, only in the last year and a half or so, you know?
Yeah.
because it really was turned up for a bit, and I think it was 2012 when they went through that whole back and forth around Wimbledon, where Serena made some comments. Like, Serena started some shit that
time. She did start it, but Maria certainly finished it.
And, you know,
she got vicious.
I give her props because, like, Serena had that one coming.
No, she did. Serena said that, oh, Maria's just pressed because she's not invited to the cool parties. Mm-hmm. And then Maria really, like, turned it up, though. She said something about how Serena's dating a married man with kids.
No, Serena talked about Blackheart and Grigor and all that stuff. Like, this is a print article where you're being interviewed in a magazine. And this is... It's all about you. There's no need for that. You know, it's not like if you're responding to somebody else's shade, then maybe you can go there. But like she started it, like if Maria is a little bit heavy handed in return, even though you may not like Maria that much, like Serena had it coming. You.
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I love Maria.
It was hilarious regardless.
Yes.
But they have turned it down a little bit. And, you know, even though Maria has yet to overcome the win streak, you know, they've been very cordial and respectful of each other in public since, and in the matches that they've played. So,
and I will say, Maria has really sort of set the tone for that. Mm-hmm. She's been very gracious in her many defeats.
Yeah. It's hard to lose that much.
I think
about how much you hate losing.
Yeah.
That's something you and Serena have in common.
That's why I don't gamble.
That's also why we don't play video games anymore, because we've had to replace remote controllers.
Excuse
too much.
Me, nobody needs to know that. So anyway, that's see what had happened was this week.
Mm-hmm. Sufficiently juicy, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so.
And I'm going to use this opportunity to plug my own shit. So if you haven't already, check out the piece.
Sportscribe.ca.
Uh-huh.
You'll find it.
There's a few laughs in there. There's also a little bit of shading of Sloane and Ariana Grande, which you called me a shady bitch because I did that.
You ain't right.
Well, you know, fine. I accept. So I guess we should get to the actual live tennis that's been happening.
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned before the clay swing started that this is one of my favorite times of the season. And I'd like to go ahead and take that back. Because as a fan, this has been a really incredibly disappointing few tournaments for me.
There's been that element, but also there hasn't been a whole lot of great tennis either, I don't feel.
No, I don't think so.
You know, there hasn't been many thrills, excitements. The time difference also doesn't help. I'm sure we've missed a lot, but it just seems altogether forgettable. And when you pair that with all these false narratives and ridiculous things that people are trying to say about any number of people's chances for Roland Garros, it just becomes so tiresome.
False narratives. I'm here for that. What are you talking about?
Oh, you know, Rafa's body is finally, you know, betraying him.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's done. It's Novak's time. Rafa is looking like one of Tom Brady's balls, pretty much.
What?
Deflated.
Oh.
Get it?
Oh, got it. Got it. Allegedly.
And that's the biggest problem for me with tennis media, is that this constant need to drum up controversy for, you know, clicks. It's just, it's suffocating for intellectual thought about what's actually happening. You know, if you look at what's been going on with Rafa, and if you've been paying attention, you should know that this is not new. Like, we almost lived through this exact same thing last year.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, he won Madrid last year, but anybody who watched that match should know that Kay had that match in the bag before he got injured.
Yeah.
You know?
Kay was kind of taking him to the woodshed there.
Uh-huh. There was only one way that match was ending, if not for injury.
Yeah.
And so, rather than focus on the journey, and that's what's been missed. If you look at the European clay court season from start to finish, you've missed an entire story that's unfolded in front of your eyes just because you want the headline that says Rafa's game is in a shambles.
Mm.
It's actually very interesting to watch and follow from tournament to tournament and take it step by step.
Well, Rafa's had some encouraging wins in the clay season, and he's also thrown in some clunkers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the match against Burdich and against Ferrer, which he won both, were for some people like a sign that the real Rafa was back, right?
Uh-huh.
And then he ended up losing anyway. So
I think we should be past the point of expecting Rafa to steamroll his way through a clay court season. Like, the years of him winning every single tournament leading up to Roland Garros and then Roland Garros, those days are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he's losing clay tournaments, it doesn't really mean that much to me anymore. The fact that Murray trounced him in a final, Murray's won Grand Slams.
Right.
Murray's a truly elite player, and he's no slouch on clay. So...
And he played well that day, yes, but Rafa could barely get a stroke in the court.
Yeah.
You know.
It's frustrating as a Rafa fan to see that kind of level. But, you know, credit to the opponent at some point.
Well, players used to go on court against Rafa on clay and probably think they didn't really have much of a chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now that players have watched him lose to Fanini twice, first of all, but look very...
That's the one part about this whole season that I'm totally willing to forget. The two losses to Fonini.
Yeah. But him looking very vulnerable on clay gives a lot of the top players incentive, you know?
Not even just the top players.
And who doesn't want on their resume that they've beaten it all on clay?
Mm-hmm.
It's a short list. So I'm not quite as optimistic as you are, I don't think. I think that he can win Roland Garros. I don't think he will. And from what we've seen in the past few weeks, I would be surprised if he made the final.
No, but my point isn't about whether he can win Roland Garros. To me, that's a really stupid question. And it's not about whether he will win. It's about pushing back against the people who are making those arguments, one way or the other. You know, it just seems so... useless at this point. You know, let's just watch it unfold. One of the really surprising results of the last few weeks was Petra Kvitova winning Madrid, steamrolling her way to a clay court title and blitzing Serena in the final. Like, that was a pretty hilarious... In the semifinal. Semifinal. That was a pretty hilarious result. How can you not laugh at that? You know, if you had taken a break from tennis for the week, you know, you went on vacation, you came back, and, you know, you go on WTA website and you're looking through the draw and you're like, oh, first round, second round, third round, and you see it come in and then, like, that's what you end up with. Like, you bet, come on.
Is Petra the most confounding player in the WTA? Because I swear, the week before that tournament, I had been reading all these articles about how Petra is going to be the one slam wonder. You know,
two slam wonder.
Well, but meaning that she can only play well on grass.
Okay.
And for the rest of her career, she has no hope to excel anywhere else. And all of a sudden, she's winning one of the biggest clay tournaments in the world.
Yeah. I don't know if that result changes that narrative, per se. I think it even adds to it.
Right.
In that she's so all over the place. But it also goes to show that when she is on, she can beat anybody. And,
yes.
You know, there are a lot of people who take issue with this talk about Kvitova's best being better than Serena's best.
Which, to me, is silly.
I don't think it's that silly.
Really?
I don't. And not because Serena lost to her so badly. But if you watch her play on grass and when she's zoning, there's only two players in women's tennis who can play at that level.
Who?
Serena and Kvitova. Mm-hmm. And for the better part of three sets, Venus in that match against Kvitova at Wimbledon last year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that type, that level of tennis, it's so rare.
Yes.
And there's really so few people who can play it.
Okay, but let's say Madison Keys at her best out-hit Serena Williams.
Yeah.
But Serena Williams won the tournament. Yeah.
It clearly doesn't mean that you're the best player.
Right.
Like, Sharapova has all these slam titles now, and say for maybe... what, like the 2004 Wimbledon, ironically, against Serena. And we know what that precipitated. She's had a lot of messy wins. And that's been her thing. You know, she struggles and she's a fighter and she's able to get the job done.
Yes.
So being able to blitz opponents is not any great indicator of, you know, winning slams. Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, Camilla Giorgi can zone for a match or a set.
Or a set.
Right.
And or look, like four games.
And you can watch her and wonder, how has this girl not won majors? But it's fleeting. Now, speaking of Serena, though, she has absolutely no momentum on clay this season. She won one round in Rome. She lost to Kvitova in Madrid in the semifinals.
Well, to be fair to her, she withdrew from Rome.
Yes.
So it's not like she was beaten.
Okay. Fair enough. But the injury has totally arrested whatever momentum she had from the winter, you know. I don't think that's... It's certainly not a death knell for her because...
No, I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like, she'll have... Provided she doesn't draw some ridiculous opponent in the second and third round, right. You know. She'll have time to play her way into form. She's had enough matches in the spring for it to be not that big of a factor, I feel.
As long as she's healthy.
She still only has...
I don't know what's going on about with this elbow thing, you know. But she could definitely draw Azarenka in the third, right?
I don't know what Vika's ranking will be by then.
But that would probably suck.
Yeah, yep, third round, because she's definitely below 16 right now.
Yeah, so Victoria, like, get your ranking up, because you're really starting to piss me off.
Yeah, Wozniacki is really not happy about that. She's the one who
but,
suffered the
you
most.
You know, Wozniacki has, like, 0.2 points to defend in the French Open, because she lost in the first round, so her ranking could go up if she has a good tournament. Another player who has had a very disappointing clay season is Simona Halep, because last time we talked about her, she was really kind of the name on tour. She made it to the semis in Rome and lost to Carla Suarez Navarro, which is really, it's not a big deal, really. Navarro has really come out as like probably the third, fourth, or fifth favorite at this point. She had an amazing clay season. But
all things considered, say for Serena, she's probably had the best year.
Well, in terms of Sharapova.
Like, well, yeah. But in terms of like really upping her ante, you know, it's been really impressive for Carla.
Yeah. But Simona had no wins at Madrid either, you know, which is, it's disappointing because she sort of made her name on clay. She's the defending finalist at Roland Garros this year. And it's not clear whether or not she's sort of primed to defend those points.
Again, I'm not really worried for her. I don't think these tournaments really tell us that much. I don't think we've been able to see anything that's definitive or predictive heading into Roland Garros on either side.
Okay, fair enough. Aside from Novak winning the two important tournaments.
Still. We've seen him try and try and try again and come in with the momentum before to Roland Garros to try and finally complete the career slam, and it hasn't happened. It was supposed to happen last year. It wasn't even five sets. The year before it was five sets, and he could really have considered himself unlucky to lose that match. But right. Last year, with all the momentum, it didn't even come close.
Fair enough. It doesn't happen until it happens.
Yeah,
right.
Pretty much.
I mean, Federer was on his quest to complete his career Grand Slam for a long time. And
he won only three games in one of those matches. Or four, you know?
Right. But
and this is not to say that, you know, this is just a big, grand defense of Nadal and his chances. It's just, we read too much into these things.
And, you know, it's hard to see someone do it until they actually do it.
Mm-hmm. And also, we've seen in the most... It's partly why we don't fill out draws to completion anymore. Because they just fall apart. And it's really depressing.
Yeah.
When you think you filled out a good draw and it's all in shambles by the third round. Like, the depth on tour is better on both tours. It's
silly to make these predictions, but we're going to try anyway.
The two other standout players on the ATP side have been Murray and Nishikori, wouldn't you say?
Yes, definitely. So Murray obviously, you know, came back from his honeymoon and won his first two clay tournaments ever.
Which is kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised that he had never won a clay title, even a small one, first of all. But
well, Rafa tends to play them all.
Well, right.
For starters. And the ones that Rafa hasn't won, there's Novak and Roger to go through as well.
Yes.
Who are the second and third best, depending on however you want to look at it, clay court players of the last eight to 10 years, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So it was a breakthrough for him.
Yeah, he won Munich. And then he, as everyone knows, came through the Madrid draw and beat Nadal in the final, which was really one of the biggest wins of his career.
Yeah. And then Nishikori building on his clay court success last year and U.S. Open final and backing it up again this year.
Right.
As a real bona fide breakout star on the men's tour.
He won Barcelona. He didn't play in Monte Carlo, but he lost to the eventual champions in both Madrid and Rome.
Uh-huh.
A semi and a quarterfinal. And so a very good season, clay season. Not, I mean, it could have been better, right? Yeah.
But it does nothing to hurt his chances at winning.
So I think for me, there's obviously Nadal and Djokovic at the top, but Murray and Nishikori are on equal footing for me as kind of the co-also-rans.
And it's kind of cool that you could conceivably think of the four most likely players to win a Grand Slam and Federer not being one of the four. It speaks to a pretty exciting time, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, exciting for whom, really?
Exactly. And then on the women's side, you know, Serena shows up, she has a chance. That's a given. Maria, I think, is probably the favorite to win. She's won it twice. She's got lots of matches under her belt now. She won Rome. Simona has a chance.
Of course, though, yep.
You know, you may not have been as pleased with her results so far. And if you're looking for a dark horse, it has to be Suarez Navarro, no?
Right. Is she even a dark horse anymore, though?
Still, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, she's never won anything big.
Right.
You know?
No, that's true. I guess, like we said before, you can't believe it will happen until it happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to mention Kvitova and Kerber in the conversation.
And Kuznetsova. Which is crazy to think, but this is how she's won her majors, you know?
You know, she is something of a clay genius, too, you know? So Svetlana probably has Petra beat in the confounding category, right?
She may be the most confounding tennis player in history.
Right. One of the best athletes, maybe, we've ever seen on a tennis court. And one of the most naturally gifted and exciting to watch. But she, you know, she's underachieved, I think, in her career. But she comes out of nowhere. She really does. And she did come out of nowhere in 2009 to win the French.
I'm also more than happy to not talk about Bouchard at all leading into this tournament. Like, she had those three semifinals, went a step further at Wimbledon last year to the final. But she's at the point now where she has to prove herself again.
Yeah, and then I'm not going to kick her while she's down.
I'm not going to kick her while she's down. But then her coach, Wim Fassett, is talking about, you know, they're really only thinking about 2016 now, which is crazy considering there's only been one major played this year.
Yeah.
There's so much tennis left.
This season is not a wash. And think of the points.
Yeah.
You know?
It's almost as if you're setting her up to fail or to explain away her failure. It's totally bizarre to me.
Maybe it's an attempt to sort of alleviate the pressure off her.
Yeah.
You know, in that she has nothing to lose. I actually liked her attitude a lot more because she sort of acknowledged the sophomore slump and was kind of like, yeah, so what of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously she's not playing her best tennis right now and she's not afraid to say.
Yeah, and I'm happy to give her space to grow a little bit as a tennis player. I'm just mostly happy that I don't have to deal with all these next best narratives.
Yeah.
You know?
But when the French Open's on TV in Canada, if she or Milos are playing, they're going to be playing on all five channels.
Well, it's possible that Milos won't even play because he's got this foot injury again. He had to have some...
Oh, a nerve injury in his foot. Yeah, that's really...
minor surgery, I think they said.
Yeah, that's too bad, though.
And if Jeannie's not up to scratch in the first few matches, you know, it could work out very well for us in terms of being able to watch more matches on TV.
The shade of it all.
It's really unfortunate, you know, the way they're, I suppose, rightfully hyped in their home country, and the fact that we happen to live here makes it very difficult to root for them because we suffer in terms of being able to follow other matches.
Yeah.
It's hard not to resent them a little bit, if we're being honest.
And we are.
So look out for the next episode, which will be coming in the next couple of days. You can consider this one and the next as a kind of tandem French Open preview. And also, I've started writing for Last Word on Sports, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly new outfit, which is trying to get its name out there. They cover all sorts of sports, but I'll be doing tennis, obviously. You can find that very easily if you so choose.
So you can find the links on Jonathan's Twitter, SportsScribeCA, or on lastwordonsports.com.
Uh-huh.
So I am James. My Twitter is at ElliotJMR.
As usual, please give us all the feedback in the world. If you think we suck, let us know.
Well,
we'll take it into consideration. iTunes reviews are always welcomed. Like and share us on Twitter. I guess favorite is the correct terminology.
And, we're old.
Yeah. All right, till next time.